you know, if you stand at the bottom of a mountain and just watch an avalanche come down, what you are seeing is undeniably breathtakingly
Oh,
complex.
absolutely. It's pure chaos.
Right. It's millions of jagged rocks, thousands of tons of snow, the dust, all interacting in this incredibly unpredictable way. Every single collision is unique.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, when the dust finally settles, it's just gravity.
Exactly. It's just gravity. It's raw, unguided physics pulling mass downward to its, you know, its lowest possible energy state.
Right.
But now imagine walking through that exact same valley, past all the rubble, and finding a fully constructed functional cathedral just standing there.
That would definitely catch your eye.
Yeah, I mean, you see perfectly balanced stone arches, intricate stained glass windows depicting historical scenes, flying buttresses supporting the walls. Both the avalanche and the cathedral involve highly complex arrangements of matter, right? Millions of atoms interacting.
Yeah.
But we instantly, intuitively recognize that the cathedral represents something entirely different. I mean, it requires a blueprint. It requires foresight.
It requires structural engineering.
Yes.
One is a direct consequence of blind physical laws just seeking equilibrium. The other is a consequence of specified information directing matter to do something it would never, ever naturally do on its own.
Right.
It's the fundamental difference between a pattern and a program.
And that distinction between the pattern of an avalanche and the program of a cathedral is exactly what we're diving into today.
We really are.
We are going to completely reframe how you think about the origin of life on Earth. We're looking past the romanticized high school textbook narratives. You know the
Oh, the
ones,
warm little pond.
yes, Charles Darwin's famous warm little pond, slowly bubbling with simple chemicals over billions of years until a microscopic bug magically crawls out.
Right, the classic story.
We are setting the philosophy totally aside today, and we're going to focus strictly, ruthlessly, on the physical and mathematical reality of what it actually takes to build a living cell from scratch.
Right, and our guide for this analysis is an incredibly rigorous piece of source material.
It is.
We're looking exclusively at Chapter 4 of Mohammed Tariq Arbab's 2026 work, The Origin Enigma, specifically sections 4.1 through 4.14.
Yeah, it's dense, but so good.
It is. Arbab methodically breaks down the scientific bottlenecks, the information theory, and the actual physical hardware required for life. And before we really get into the weeds here, I want to establish the ground rules for how we are going to approach this.
Okay, lay him out.
Our tone today is going to be one of absolute clinical detachment.
I like that. Hard hats on.
Exactly. Hard hats on. We're not here to debate metaphysics, theology, or philosophy. We are going to step into the role of structural engineers.
Just looking at the bolts and the beams.
Right. We're going to look at the chemical laws of the universe impartially and demonstrate exactly where unguided chemistry hits insurmountable, empirically verified physical hard stops.
Okay, let's unpack this because Arbab starts by identifying a massive foundational mistake that he says has derailed nearly a century of origin of life research.
Yeah, he calls it a category error.
Right, a category error. What exactly is a category error when we're talking about the chemistry of early Earth?
Well, category error occurs when you attribute the properties of one kind of thing to something that belongs to a completely different category.
Like comparing apples to, well, not even oranges, apples to abstract math concepts or something.
Basically, yeah. In origin of life research, the foundational mistake is the assumption that life is merely a highly complex arrangement of chemicals.
Okay.
The logic goes, if life is just complex chemistry, then if you give simple chemicals enough time, enough heat, and enough energy, they will inevitably self-organize into biology.
Because that's what chemicals do, they react.
Right, but Arbab, relying on the pioneering work of information theorists like Hubert Yockey, points out that this treats life as a purely chemical phenomenon. It completely misses the reality that life is actually an information processing system.
So it's confusing the physical hardware with the software.
Precisely. Let's look at how physics naturally operates without biological intervention.
However,
The laws of physics dictate how atoms behave based on mass, charge, and thermodynamics. So if you take sodium ions and chloride ions and mix them together, electromagnetic forces dictate that they will attract one another and form a salt crystal.
just automatically.
Automatically, the structure is repetitive, it's highly ordered, it forms a perfectly periodic lattice.
Like a grid.
Exactly. You can predict the entire structure of a massive salt crystal from a single, simple physical rule. It has very low entropy, meaning it's highly ordered. But it also contains effectively zero information.
Because it's just repeating itself.
Right. It's just sodium chloride over and over. Biological polymers, though, specifically DNA, RNA, and proteins, are fundamentally different. They are what chemists call a periodic.
A periodic, meaning they don't just repeat the same rigid pattern over and over again like a crystal.
Exactly. Let's zoom in on the structure of DNA. You have the backbone of the molecule, which is made of alternating sugar and phosphate molecules.
Like the sides of a ladder.
Yeah, exactly like the sides of a ladder.
Uh-huh.
The chemical bonds connecting that backbone to the nucleotide bases, adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine, are identical for all four bases.
Or rungs of the ladder.
Right. But because the thermodynamic bond affinities are equal,
yeah,
there is no physical or chemical law that forces an adenine to be followed by a cytosine or a guanine or a thymine.
Wait, really?
Yes. The sequence is chemically arbitrary.
Wait, I want to make sure I'm fully grasping this. You're saying the physical chemistry binding the molecule together doesn't actually care what order the letters are in?
That's right. It doesn't care at all. And because the sequence is chemically free to vary, it possesses the exact property required to function as a medium for storing information.
This makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Let me try an analogy to make this concrete, because this is honestly a massive paradigm shift.
Go for it.
What you're saying is that trying to explain the origin of life's genetic code by studying the laws of chemistry is, it's like trying to explain Shakespeare's sonnets by analyzing the chemical properties of the ink and the paper.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. It really is.
Think about it. If you take an electron microscope to a physical copy of Hamlet, you will find all sorts of interesting chemistry.
Oh, sure.
You'll find interlocking cellulose fibers in the paper. You'll find pigment molecules in the ink, binding agents. You can map every single chemical bond.
Yep.
But no matter how deeply you understand the fluid dynamics of the ink or the organic chemistry of the paper, it will never, ever explain why those specific ink molecules are arranged to spell the phrase to be or not to be. The paper and the ink are the medium. They are necessary to hold the message. But they don't dictate the message. The laws of physics can explain the ink. They cannot explain the sonnet.
And that perfectly encapsulates the category error. The laws of physics and chemistry can explain the sugar phosphate backbone of DNA. They can explain the ink and the paper.
But not the sequence.
Right. They cannot explain the sequential arrangement of the bases, which is the biological sonnet. And this brings us directly into what Arbab calls the information enigma. To understand the software of life, we have to distinguish between two totally different types of information.
Okay, lay them out for us.
First, there is Shannon information, named after the mathematician Claude Shannon, who basically founded modern information theory in the 1940s.
Okay.
Shannon information simply measures the unpredictability or the data storage capacity of a sequence. So if I give you a completely random string of letters like XQJKZW that has high Shannon information because it's highly unpredictable.
You couldn't guess the next letter based on the previous one.
Right.
But it's also totally useless. You know, it's just gibberish.
Exactly. It lacks the second, far more crucial type semantic information.
Semantic information.
Also known as specified complexity. Semantic information is highly improbable, just like a random string, but it is functionally arranged to convey meaning or execute a highly specific task.
Okay, I'm following.
The central dogma of molecular biology, the process where the code in DNA is transcribed into RNA, which is then translated into three-dimensional proteins, relies entirely, 100%, on semantic information.
And reading through Arbab's text, what really blew my mind is that this translation process relies on an actual literal symbolic convention.
It does.
I mean, we always use the word code when talking about DNA, but I always assumed it was just a metaphor.
Yeah.
Like a loose chemical analogy, but it's not a metaphor, is it?
No, it is not a metaphor. It is quite literally a symbolic code.
That's wild.
In the genetic code, a specific triplet of nucleotides, which we call a codon, like GCC codes for the amino acid alanine. But here is the critical part. There is absolutely no thermodynamic or chemical necessity for GCC to pair with alanine.
None.
None. It is an arbitrary symbolic convention.
So how does the cell know what it means? If physics doesn't demand it, what does?
It's enforced by a massive suite of complex adapter molecules called transfer RNAs and specific charging enzymes called aminosyl tRNA synthetases.
Okay, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, but basically the codon means alanine only because the biological system as a whole has effectively agreed on that convention.
Wow.
It's much like how the English language has agreed that the letters D-O-G represent a four-legged canine.
Right. D-O-G doesn't look like a dog or sound like a bark. It's just an agreed-upon symbol.
Precisely. Physics and chemistry, left to their own devices without a pre-existing system, drive matter either toward repetitive low-energy crystals, like the salt we discussed, or toward highly entropic, disordered liquids and gases.
Just a mess.
Yeah. There is no known physical law that generates arbitrary semantic symbolic conventions.
Okay, I'm following the logic, but I have to push back here.
Yeah.
I really want to stress test this.
Please do.
I understand that the sequence is chemically arbitrary.
Yeah.
And I understand it's a symbolic code.
Yeah.
But early Earth had an ocean the size of the Pacific, right? And it had hundreds of millions of years.
Yes.
Couldn't raw physical forces, ocean currents, thermal vents, lightning strikes, radioactive decay, couldn't they eventually, just by sheer brute force trial and error, carve out these symbolic codes?
I see where you're going.
I mean, if you roll the dice enough times, eventually you get a Yahtzee, right?
Clinically speaking, no.
No.
And it's crucial to understand that this answer isn't based on a gap in our scientific knowledge. It is based on a positive, mathematically verified understanding of how thermodynamics operates.
Mm-hmm.
Physics strictly drives toward equilibrium. To claim that a random physical force or a billion years of random physical forces can carve out a semantic communication protocol is to assign a magical property to matter that matter demonstrably does not possess.
So it's not just unlikely, it's contrary to how matter actually behaves.
It would be functionally identical to expecting a hurricane blowing through a junkyard to accidentally assemble a fully functioning, flight-ready Boeing 747.
The classic junkyard tornado.
Exactly. The physical forces are blind. They possess no memory, they have no goal, and they do not anticipate functional outcomes.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. Because if we agree that life requires this semantic specified code, this biological software, the immediate next question we have to ask is, what are the actual odds?
Right.
Can blind chance mathematically stumble upon even one tiny piece of that code? Let's talk about the sheer scale of the math, what Arbab calls combinatorial inflation.
Yeah, to appreciate this, we need to comprehend the scale of the combinatorial space, the realm of possible sequences that we are dealing with. Proteins are the fundamental workhorses of the cell. They are the machines that do almost everything. They're linear chains built from an alphabet of 20 canonical amino acids.
20 letters in the alphabet.
Right. But in order for a protein to do its job, it can't just be a floppy string. It has to fold up into a highly specific three-dimensional geometric shape.
Right, like a microscopic origami structure.
Exactly. And the shape it folds into is determined entirely by the sequence of those 20 different amino acids. Let's take a very modest protein domain. Just 150 amino acids long.
Which is pretty short, right?
That is quite short by biological standards. The total number of possible ways to arrange those 20 different amino acids into a chain of 150 is 20 to the power of 150.
Which, mathematically, comes out to roughly 10 to the power of 195 possible sequences.
Correct. 10 with 195 zeros after it.
That is, I mean, that's impossible to picture.
It is. To put that number into perspective, let's look at the universe. The estimated number of elementary particles, every proton, every neutron, every electron in the entire observable universe is about 10 to the power of 80.
Wait, the whole universe is only 10 to the 80th.
Yes. So the number of possible sequences for one single short protein exceeds the number of elementary particles in the universe by over 100 orders of magnitude.
See, a number like 10 to the 195 is so astronomically large, honestly breaks the human brain.
Yeah.
We literally can't conceptualize it.
We can't.
But the critical question here isn't just the total number of possibilities, right? The question is, how many of those 10 to the 195 sequences actually do anything useful?
Yes.
Because if, say, half of them fold up into working proteins, then blind chance has a pretty good shot.
Yeah.
It wouldn't matter how big the ocean of possibilities is if half the water is functional.
That is the exact right question to ask. And for a very long time in evolutionary biology, it was simply assumed that functional proteins were incredibly common in sequence space.
People just assumed it.
Yeah, it was assumed that chance could easily stumble upon them. But in 2004, a molecular biologist named Douglas Ax performed a landmark, exhaustive series of experiments to actually measure this.
Wow.
He used site-directed mutagenesis to systematically mutate enzymes and empirically measure the density of functional, stably folding sequences within this vast combinatorial space.
So he physically tested the limits.
Yes. He wasn't making a theoretical guess. He was physically measuring the tolerance of the protein to mutation before the 3D structure collapsed.
And what was the ratio? How many functional sequences are hiding in the gibberish?
Ax found that the ratio of functional stably folding protein sequences to non-functional unfolded gibberish is exactly 1 in 10 to the power of 77.
1 in 10 to the power of 77.
Let that sink in.
Okay, I want to really visualize this for you, the listener, so you can feel the weight of that number. Imagine we take the entire Milky Way galaxy, not our solar system, the entire galaxy, hundreds of billions of stars, and all the planets, asteroids, dust, and gas swirling around them.
It's massive.
Right. Now imagine we could somehow count every single individual atom in that entire galaxy. Imagine I take one single atom, I mark it with a microscopic red dot, and I throw it back into the galaxy and stir it all up. Your task is to reach out, blindfolded, into the spinning cosmos and pick that exact marked atom on your very first try.
That's a great visual.
That is what a 1 in 10 to the 77 chance looks like. And remember, that mathematical nightmare is just to find one single functional protein. A minimal living cell requires hundreds of specific interlocking proteins all functioning together simultaneously.
Which brings us to the concept of the universal probability bound, a metric calculated by mathematician William Dembski.
Right, the absolute limit.
Exactly. If you take the total number of particles in the universe, multiply it by the absolute maximum rate at which physical transitions can occur, which is Planck time, and multiply that by the entire age of the universe in seconds, you get an absolute physical ceiling.
Which is what?
About 10 to the power of 140 possible physical events since the Big Bang.
Since the very beginning of time.
Right. A single minimal cell requiring hundreds of specific proteins shatters that bound completely. Unguided chemistry simply runs out of probabilistic resources. It runs out of universe.
Okay, wait. I'm stuck on something here. I've read Richard Dawkins. A lot of people have.
Sure.
And I distinctly remember reading about his famous computer simulation, the Weasel Program.
Ah. Sure.
Dawkins created a program to show that a random string of letters could evolve into the Shakespearean phrase, "Methinks it is like a weasel," incredibly fast.
He did.
He didn't need 10 to the 195 tries. He used cumulative selection. He ran a program, it mutated letters randomly, kept the ones that accidentally matched the target and threw away the rest, and boom, in just a few dozen generations, he had the target phrase.
Right.
Doesn't that solve the math problem? Doesn't cumulative selection cut right through that massive combinatorial inflation?
This raises an extremely important question, and it's one that RBAB's source material dismantles with absolute clinical precision.
Okay, let's hear it.
William Dembski and Robert Marks published a devastating, peer-reviewed critique of Dawkins' simulation. Dawkins' program works. It finds the target quickly, only because it smuggles in what information theorists call active information.
Active information, what does that mean?
It means the target phrase, the final goal, is known in advance by the computer programmer. And partial matches are recognized, rewarded, and preserved for the next generation.
But nature doesn't have a target.
Precisely. Nature has no foresight. It has no goal. In real, unguided prebiotic chemistry, there is no reward for a partial match.
Wow.
If an amino acid sequence is 10% correct, or 50% correct, or even 90% correct, it does not fold into a functional three-dimensional shape.
And if it doesn't fold?
Because it doesn't fold, its hydrophobic core is exposed to water. It is completely useless to the environment. And because it's useless, it does not get preserved. Thermodynamics takes over, and the chain is rapidly degraded by water through a chemical process called hydrolysis.
So it falls apart.
It falls apart long before it can mutate further.
Oh, wow. Okay, I've got an analogy for this.
Let's hear it.
It's like trying to open a combination padlock. A blind chemical search in nature is like a padlock that only clicks open if all the dials are perfectly aligned at the exact same time.
Right.
You don't get a reward. You don't hear a little click for getting the first number right. If it's not all perfectly aligned, it stays locked. But Dawkins' model is like a magical rigged padlock that clicks and locks into place every single time you get one single number right, saving your progress.
Exactly. Dawkins rigged the padlock.
Of course, you can crack a code fast if the lock saves your progress and guides you to the answer. But chemistry doesn't save partial progress.
It doesn't. Furthermore, natural selection, the very mechanism Dawkins is trying to simulate, is based on differential reproduction. It requires an organism that is already capable of replicating itself accurately.
Right. You can't have natural selection without something to select from.
You logically cannot invoke natural selection to explain the origin of the first replicating organism, because natural selection doesn't exist until that organism is already alive and functioning.
That is a massive catch-22.
It is. The blind search for the first functional proteins has to be a single simultaneous draw from the full sequence space. Invoking cumulative selection to explain the origin of life is a profound logical fallacy.
So chance cannot find the proteins. The mathematical boundaries strictly forbid it.
They do.
But let's say, just for the sake of argument, a miracle happens. Let's zoom out from the sequence of a single protein and look at the system level. How do the components of the cell interact? Because this brings us to what Arbab calls the bootstrap problem.
The bootstrap problem is essentially irreducible complexity occurring at the molecular systems level.
Okay.
It describes a situation where a system is composed of several interacting parts, and the system absolutely cannot function unless all the parts are present simultaneously.
Give me an example in the cell.
The most glaring, insurmountable example is the relationship between DNA and proteins. DNA, as we discussed, is the hard drive. It encodes the instructions to build proteins.
Right.
Among the proteins it codes for are vital enzymes like polymerases, which are the machines that copy the DNA, and helicases, which are the motors that unzip the double helix so it can be read.
Right. So the DNA holds the blueprints for the machines.
But here is the structural paradox. To read the DNA blueprint and to transcribe it into RNA and to translate it into a protein, you strictly require those exact same protein machines.
Wait.
You cannot read the genetic code without the specialized protein machines, but you cannot build the specialized protein machines without the genetic code.
It's a massive molecular catch-22. Wait, so if the DNA has the blueprint, but it needs the protein to read the blueprint, that's exactly like trying to build a massive automated manufacturing plant.
Go on.
Imagine you want to build a factory. To build the factory walls and assemble the complex assembly lines, you need heavy machinery cranes, bulldozers, advanced robotics.
Yep.
But there's a catch. The only place in the entire universe that manufactures those specific cranes and bulldozers is inside the factory itself.
Exactly.
You can't construct the factory without the heavy machinery, but you can't manufacture the heavy machinery without a fully functional factory. It's a closed loop.
It is a logically and physically closed loop. No stepwise, unguided, gradual evolutionary process can break into a circle at any point.
Because it all has to be there at once.
Exactly. A half-finished factory cannot produce half-finished bulldozers to complete its own construction. And to make matters worse, Arbab's text points out another layer of this circularity, the energy factor.
Right, because doing all this molecular construction requires power.
An immense amount of power, specifically chemical energy in the form of ATP adenosine triphosphate.
ATP.
Synthesizing these massive DNA and protein polymers requires an enormous continuous supply of ATP. But how does a modern cell produce ATP?
How does it?
It uses highly complex, irreducibly complex protein engines, most notably an enzyme called ATP synthase.
Okay, ATP synthase.
ATP synthase is literally a microscopic rotary electric motor embedded in the cell membrane.
Wait, a literal motor?
A literal mechanical motor. It has a stator, a rotor, and a drive shaft. It spins at thousands of RPMs, powered by a flow of protons, mechanically snapping phosphate groups onto ADP to create ATP. It is a marvel of nanoengineering.
That's insane.
But synthesizing the ATP synthase motor requires massive amounts of ATP to read the DNA and translate the proteins to build the motor in the first place.
So you need the energy to build the motor, but you need the motor to get the energy. The factory analogy holds up again. You need the nuclear power plant to run the cranes and the robots, but you need the cranes and the robots to build the nuclear power plant.
From our position of clinical detachment, evaluating this purely as structural engineers, this demonstrates that partial assembly of a cell is biologically non-viable.
It just doesn't work.
Selection has absolutely no purchase here. All the components, the information storage system, the translation machinery, and the energy harnessing engines must come into existence simultaneously and fully integrated, or the system does not function at all.
it dies.
Okay, let's push the boundaries even further. Let's pretend against all mathematical reality that you have the DNA, you have the folded proteins, and you have the ATP just floating around in a primordial ocean.
Okay, quite miracle.
You've somehow beaten the odds. Can you just swirl them together in a test tube and get a living cell?
No.
Because Arbab highlights something called the systems complexity problem and the membrane paradox. What happens when we actually try to physically contain these ingredients?
This touches on the groundbreaking work of physiologist Dennis Noble regarding systems biology. The core realization is that life is a property of integrated systems, not merely a list of molecular ingredients.
Okay.
If you put all the correct DNA, all the correct glycerin, and all the right proteins into a test tube and shake it up, you do not get a living cell. You get a biochemical soup.
Because it's lacking structure. It's just a disorganized mess.
Precisely. DNA only encodes linear sequence information, one-dimensional strings of amino acids. But a living cell requires unbelievably precise three-dimensional spatial and temporal organization.
Like the architecture of a house.
Exactly. Where does a specific protein go once it's built? Does it go to the membrane? Does it stay in the nucleus? When is it activated? This 3D architecture cannot be found in the DNA. It is inherited structurally directly from the parent cell's membrane.
Wait, so the structure comes from outside the DNA?
The spatial organization is transmitted top down. It is not built bottom up from scattered parts. The overall system organizes the molecules. The molecules do not spontaneously organize into a system.
But wait, what about protocells? You hear about this all the time in science media. Couldn't early life just use simple soap bubbles, basically, to contain the chemistry?
The lipid bubbles?
Yeah, I've seen videos online where researchers show lipids spontaneously forming these little spherical membranes in water. Looks like a little cell.
You are referring to lipid vesicles, and it is entirely true that pure fatty acids can spontaneously assemble into membranous spheres under certain wet-dry cycling conditions. That is simple physical chemistry.
So what's the problem?
The source material highlights a lethal biophysical catch-22 known as the membrane paradox. A simple, pure fatty acid vesicle will form a closed boundary, yes. But that boundary is completely impermeable to charged ions and large polar molecules.
Meaning things can't get in or out of the bubble?
Exactly. It blocks the very nutrients, nucleotides, and amino acids required to maintain any internal prebiotic chemistry.
Let me see if I've got an analogy for this.
Try it.
It's like you're trying to build a highly secure, impenetrable bank vault to protect all your life savings. You pour the concrete, you reinforce it with steel, you seal it up perfectly.
Oh, great vault.
But you build it so perfectly that you forget to install any doors. You've successfully contained the space, but the inside of the vault is utterly useless because nothing can ever enter or leave. The inside starves.
That's exactly it.
How does a modern living cell solve the vault problem then?
Modern cells solve it by embedding complex active transport protein channels into the lipid membrane. These are sophisticated, highly engineered molecular gates that selectively allow specific nutrients in while simultaneously pumping toxic waste out.
Gates.
But here's the paradox rearing its head again. To synthesize those highly complex transport proteins, you already need a fully functioning internal genetic and metabolic system.
Oh, man. Another loop.
Yes. The simple vesicle cannot survive without the complex transport channels to feed it, but the channels cannot be manufactured without a prior functioning internally complex cell. It is a hard biophysical stop.
A vault with no doors.
Mm.
That is brilliant and, frankly, terrifying for the naturalistic model.
It really is.
Okay, we've looked at these specific bottlenecks, the staggering math of the proteins, the circular factories, the impenetrable vaults. Let's take all of these concepts and lay them out sequentially on a timeline. Let's walk the path from dead chemistry to a living cell.
The prebiotic ladder.
Right. If we look at the 8-stage prebiotic ladder detailed in Arbab's text, how far does unguided nature actually get?
The prebiotic ladder is a highly useful framework for auditing laboratory claims against geological and thermodynamic reality. It maps out 8 necessary stages. Let's walk through them clinically.
Okay, rung by rung.
Stage 1 is geochemical precursors. This is the formation of basic atmospheric gases and simple organic compounds.
What's the status here? Do we pass step 1?
We do. Status is a success. Raw planetary conditions, volcanic gases, ultraviolet light, thermal heat can indeed produce simple organic molecules. Unstructured carbon compounds can form naturally.
Okay, run 1 is solid. Nature can make the dirt. What's next?
Stage two is biochemical monomers. So this is making the specific building blocks, the 20 biological amino acids, and the 4 nucleotides.
Can nature do this?
Here the process begins faltering dramatically. This is where we hit what chemists call the zoo problem.
The zoo problem.
Think back to the famous Miller-Urey experiment in the 1950s. They put gases in a flask, sparked it with electricity to simulate lightning, and created some amino acids.
Right, that's in every high school textbook.
It was heralded as the secret to life. But what the textbooks often leave out is that when you do this, you don't just get the 20 canonical amino acids used in biology. You get hundreds and hundreds of non-canonical imposter molecules, structural isomers, and chemical variants.
The zoo of chemicals.
You get a massive chemical zoo. And the biological signal, the few molecules you actually want, is entirely drowned out by overwhelming chemical noise.
So you're trying to build a highly specific Lego castle, but for every standard rectangular brick you find, you have to dig through 1,000 warped, melted, circular, or totally incompatible pieces of plastic. They just won't snap together.
Exactly. And even if you could somehow sort out the chemical noise, you immediately hit stage three. The homochirality threshold.
Homochirality.
And this is a catastrophic hard stop. This is the poison pill of unguided chemistry. Biological proteins absolutely require 100% left-handed amino acids.
I need to pause here because this is crucial. What does left-handed mean in chemistry? Do molecules have hands?
Many complex molecules are chiral, meaning they exist in two mirror image forms. Think of your left hand and your right hand. They have the same fingers, the same mass, but you cannot perfectly superimpose your left hand onto your right hand. They are mirror images.
Right.
In chemistry, these are called enantiomers. Unguided prebiotic chemistry strictly produces a racemic mixture, a perfect 50-50 blend of left-handed and right-handed molecules.
And why is that a hard stop? If a right-handed amino acid accidentally slips into the protein chain, does it just slow the machine down a little bit?
No, it causes a phenomenon called enantiomeric cross-inhibition. It completely destroys the structure.
What destroys it?
Remember we discussed how proteins must fold into a 3D shape? A very common shape is the alpha helix, which resembles a coiled spring. The geometry of a left-handed alpha helix is exquisitely precise. If even a single right-handed amino acid is incorporated into a growing left-handed chain, its side chains point in the wrong physical direction. It causes a steric clash. The atoms literally bump into each other where they shouldn't.
Oh, wow.
It permanently breaks the coil, destroying the chain's ability to fold into its functional shape. It acts as a structural poison.
Because nature can't sort them.
Sis, unguided nature has no physical mechanism to sort left-handed molecules from right-handed molecules before they link up. Assembling a pure left-handed chain of 150 amino acids by blind chance is a probability of 1 in 2 to the power of 150. The pathway is definitively blocked.
Wow. One wrong molecule and the whole spring snaps. Let's pretend a miracle happens and all the right-handed molecules magically disappear.
Okay, a huge miracle.
Now we are at stage 4, non-enzymatic polymerization. We need to link these pure left-handed amino acids together into long chains, but without any cellular machines to help us.
Another hard stop. Here we hit the thermodynamic barrier of hydrolysis and the kinetic barrier of the asphalt problem.
Let's look at hydrolysis first.
We are assuming life started in an aqueous environment, an ocean or a pond. But thermodynamics drives water to aggressively break chemical bonds apart, not join them together.
Wait, water breaks them apart?
Yes. The equilibrium shifts heavily toward destruction. Without a biological machine to continuously input energy and protect the bond, water wins. The chain falls apart faster than it can grow.
Water is the enemy of forming the chain. That is so counterintuitive because we always hear, follow the water to find life. But what about the asphalt problem?
Furthermore, if you have a realistic primordial soup containing both amino acids and sugars, which you would need for DNA, they don't form neat biological polymers. Kinetically, they vastly prefer to react with each other via the Maillard reaction.
Wait, isn't the Maillard reaction what happens when I sear a steak on the grill? Or when I toast bread? The browning effect.
Exactly. It's the rapid cross-linking of amino acids and sugars into inert, brown, highly stable tar. Chemists call them melanoidin polymers. In a realistic prebiotic pool, the necessary ingredients rapidly cook themselves into useless asphalt before they can ever form a delicate information-bearing genetic code.
Okay, so we are essentially dead in the water or dead in the tar at rung four.
We are.
But let's keep climbing. Let's say we magically bypass the tar. Stage 5, compartmentalization, getting it inside a membrane.
We discussed the membrane paradox earlier, the vault with no doors, but there is an additional severe chemical conflict here called the magnesium paradox.
What's that?
Jack Sostak, a Nobel laureate, spent years trying to create an RNA world in the lab. To get RNA to fold properly and act as a catalyst, you need very high concentrations of divalent magnesium ions in the water.
Okay.
But those exact same high magnesium concentrations aggressively bind to the charged heads of fatty acids, and they completely precipitate and shred fatty acid protocell membranes.
Wait, so the exact chemical environment required for the software to function completely destroys the hardware trying to contain it?
Yes.
Nature's just thrown up brick walls at every single step. Okay, stage six is functional information.
Which is the sequence enigma we've exhaustively covered. The impossible jump from repetitive chemical order to the aperiodic semantic complexity of the genetic code, navigating a combinatorial space of 10 to the power of 195 without an oracle.
Right, the Milky Way atom analogy. Stage 7, metabolic energy coupling.
You might have abundant raw energy from a deep sea hydrothermal vent or lightning or UV radiation, but raw energy is destructive. It just cooks organic matter.
You need a way to harness it.
Exactly. To couple that chaotic energy to a delicate biological process, you already need pre-existing, irreducibly complex nanomachinery like the ATP synthase motor to safely harness the flow of protons and translate it into a usable, stable chemical currency. Raw energy without an engine is just a bomb.
Just a bomb. And finally, stage 8, systems integration.
The ultimate bootstrap problem. The genome, the metabolic engines, and the selectively permeable membrane must all come online simultaneously in the exact same microscopic space.
Though no step by step.
Right. Darwinian selection cannot begin to optimize anything. It cannot save partial progress until the entire integrated system is already fully functioning and capable of replicating itself.
So let's step back and look at the big picture here. If we look at this prebiotic ladder, unguided chemistry effectively halts at stage 2.
It does.
You get a toxic zoo of chemical noise.
Yeah.
Every single step after that is a physical, mathematical, or thermodynamic wall.
Correct.
But this raises a massive question for me. If these hard stops are so absolute, why do we constantly see headlines claiming scientists are close to creating life in the lab? It feels like every 6 months there's a new article saying origins of life solved or building blocks of life created in a test tube.
Oh, I know.
How do we reconcile the breathless headlines with the brutal chemistry we just discussed?
This is perhaps the most practical, actionable takeaway for anyone reading scientific literature or mainstream media on this topic. RBEB provides a clinical taxonomy of 6 logical fallacies that completely pervade prebiotic research.
A taxonomy of fallacies. I like that.
Whenever you see a headline claiming a breakthrough in abiogenesis, you can almost always run it through this taxonomy, use it as a sort of BS detector, and you will find the investigator actively smuggling their own intelligence into the experiment.
Okay, let's outline how they actually do this. Fallacy number 1 is the clean room fallacy.
Right.
This sounds like extreme investigator interference.
Yeah.
How does it work in practice?
This happens when a scientist claims to simulate early Earth conditions, but they actually use a modern sterile laboratory. They start with 99% pure, commercially purchased, biologically extracted chemical.
Which wouldn't exist on early Earth.
Not at all. They run a reaction, and then before the products can be destroyed by hydrolysis or cross-reactions, they manually intervene. They use cold traps to pull the desired product out of the reaction.
They stop it themselves.
They manually purify the intermediate. They manually shift the pH of the water and then start the next step. They are entirely substituting their own highly educated, goal-directed intelligence for the chaotic, unguided conditions of the early Earth.
So what does that actually prove?
It proves that intelligent chemists can synthesize complex molecules. It does absolutely nothing to prove that blind nature can.
Wow. So they are essentially playing God in the lab and then giving the credit to blind chance.
Exactly.
Fallacy 2, the asphalt evasion.
This is closely related. It is the practice of completely ignoring the kinetic reality of the Maillard reaction.
The tar.
Right, the tar. In a real prebiotic pool, all the chemicals are mixed together, the famous dirty water scenario. But experiments evade this by keeping incompatible chemicals artificially separated until the exact moment they are needed, precisely to prevent them from instantly cooking into useless brown tar.
They just don't let them touch until they want them to. That's cheating. Fallacy 3, the bootstrapping fallacy, assuming the target.
You see this constantly in RNA world research. Researchers will use modern biologically extracted RNA, or they will use highly optimized cellular enzymes extracted from modern bacteria, drop them into their experiments, and use them to prove how early chemistry could have worked.
Wait, they use modern enzymes to prove how the first enzymes formed?
Yes. They're assuming the existence of complex biological software to explain how biological software originated in the first place. It is a textbook example of circular reasoning.
That's crazy. Fallacy 4, the category error, linking versus sequencing.
We see this often with studies claiming that minerals or clay surfaces can catalyze the formation of life. A mineral surface acting like a tiny chemical anvil might physically force a random chemical bond to form between two amino acids.
Okay.
That is simply linking, but researchers will confuse that with the ability to write functional genetic code, which is sequencing. It's confusing the physical ability to glue two random letters together with the algorithmic ability to type out a functioning software program.
Gluing an A and a B together doesn't mean you wrote a book.
Exactly.
Fallacy 5, the Oracle fallacy.
We discussed this with Richard Dawkins. It applies to computer simulations and modern AI models predicting metabolic networks. The fallacy is smuggling active information into the simulation.
Rigging the padlock.
Right. The computer program is given a teleological target, an oracle that knows the final goal, and the programmer writes an algorithm that guides the simulation toward it. Nature has no oracle. Nature does not know what a cell is until it makes one.
And finally, fallacy 6, the deep time myth, the appeal to infinity.
This is the deeply held false belief that just giving the universe billions of years will solve all probabilistic and chemical hurdles. The reality is twofold.
What's the reality?
First, the geological window for life's origin on Earth was incredibly short, perhaps just a few tens of millions of years after the oceans cooled, according to the fossil record.
So they didn't even have billions of years?
No. And second, and more importantly, time is actually the enemy of prebiotic chemistry.
Because of water.
Because of thermodynamics, yes. It destroys unprotected polymers in hours or days via hydrolysis. When the degrading force outpaces the synthesizing force, more time means more destruction, not more progress. You don't get a protein by leaving amino acids in water for a million years. You get a soup of degraded carbon.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, whenever you, the listener, read an article about the origins of life, look closely for the invisible hand of the researcher.
Always look for the interference.
Look for the purified regions. Look for the artificial targets. Look for the meticulously controlled temperatures and pH shifts. When you look closely, the experiment isn't showing nature creating life. It's showing an intelligent designer, the scientist, carefully orchestrating chemistry to achieve a preconceived goal.
Exactly. Maintaining our clinical detachment means we evaluate the claims strictly by what unguided chemistry can achieve on its own. And when the investigator's interference is removed, the chemistry invariably reverts to its natural thermodynamic endpoints, equilibrium, salt crystals, and tar.
We have covered an immense, truly staggering amount of ground today. By keeping our hard hats on and maintaining absolute clinical detachment, we have seen that the origin of life isn't just a puzzle that's missing a few pieces. It is a sequence of insurmountable physical, mathematical, and thermodynamic hard stops.
At every level.
From the information enigma of semantic code to the sequence space of 10, to the power of 195, to the bootstrap problem of the circular factory, to the impenetrable vault of the membrane paradox, right down through the 8 impossible stages of the prebiotic ladder.
It's a wall.
So why should you care about this? Why does understanding molecular biology matter to your everyday life? Because true critical thinking means not accepting philosophical assumptions disguised as empirical science. You are now equipped with the taxonomy of fallacies. You can read the literature, watch the documentaries, and spot the investigator interference, the oracle fallacies, and the cleanroom tactics yourself.
You absolutely can.
And I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over. If we observe empirically that all biological software is encoded in a way that chemically mirrors human languages and digital codes, the arbitrary symbolic conventions, the intricate translation machinery, the complex error correction.
Mm-hmm.
And if we know with 100% empirical certainty that every single digital code, every alphabet, every software program we have ever encountered in human history comes from a conscious mind, then what happens to our scientific method if we blindly refuse to apply that exact same pattern recognition to the genome?
That is the ultimate question.
If you see an avalanche, you rightly infer gravity. If you see a cathedral, you rightly infer a blueprint and an engineer. So when we look at the breathtaking, irreducibly complex, mathematically staggering machinery of the living cell, which one are we really looking at? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. See you next time.